and want to fight the first big version of the political action.
I could try something like that. Already get fixed with a flat metric on the worksheet. And I put an untrivial metric in space-time. Now, this is an interacting theory from the point of view of the worksheet, because it's not just quadratic in the scalar fields. But it's a reasonable action to write down. But it poses an immediate puzzle. We said that gravity includes a graviton, and now we're having the string propagate in the background of a fixed background metric, which doesn't even look like it has to satisfy the Einstein equations. And this is pretty puzzling because we wouldn't expect to be able to describe the propagation of a graviton in a space-time which does not satisfy Einstein equations. So the solution of the puzzle is just that this metric, although it's classically conformally invariant, one invariant, it's not quantum mechanically one invariant or conformally invariant. Indeed, it's not even invariant under scale transformations. Why is that? So this is an interacting theory. And as you know, when you have an interacting theory, even if some couplings look marginal, look scale invariant, quantum mechanically, they might not be. So there is an RG flow. When I change the scale of my metric, the couplings will change because of quantum effects. Essentially, because when I introduce counterterms in regularizing the action in during the quantum mechanical calculation, these counterterms often involves logarithms of something over the regularization scale. So when I do a scale transformation, I'm changing the regularization scale. When I go back to the original regularization scale, I get an extra shift in various quantities. So in order to define a string theory, I need wild invariance. So this tells me that somehow this action, unless I can find a way to make it wild invariant, will not be suitable for the propagation of a string. Now, how do we capture the lack of wild invariance, of scale invariance of a theory? Well, conservation, so invariance, the invariance under scale transformations is expressed as the fact that the stress tensor should be traceless. So if the theory does not have scale invariance, does not have wild symmetry, then it means that the stress tensor on the worksheet must not be traceless. So there must be something on zero on the right-hand side. Now, this is by definition the beta function. These are the beta functions of the theory. So the right-hand side will be expanded in some operators, and the coefficients of the expansions will be called are what's called beta functions. And if you do a scale transformation of your theory, this I read it for the example general theory. If I do a scale transformation of the theory, because of this, it means that the transformation of the measure, the transformation of the theory will induce the shift. So will result in adding this tensor to the action. So if my original action had some coupling, that means that the scale transformation will change the couplings by an amount given by the beta functions. Usually when you work in perturbation theory, you write this relation. So you say that under a change of scale, the couplings change by the beta functions. Okay. Now, in this particular case, you can see that you can think about the metric as some sort of an infinite set of couplings. All classically marginal. if you wanted, you could really expand this in power series in X, say around the flat metric. And then you get terms that are, you know, like x dx dx, x squared dx dx, x cubed dx dx, and so on and so forth. This will be all interactions with couplings, which are marginal classically, and quantum mechanics can get a beta function. So you could say you could define the beta function for the matrix, say by the statement that when I do by saying that here I have something like the integral of beta mu nu, sorry, not integral, that I have beta mu nu of the matrix dx mu d bar x nu. Maybe that that's for now. So if I put a non-trivial metric, I get a non-trivial beta function, which is a function of the metric. If the metric is flat, there is no, this is zero, but the metric is curved on the spacetime, I get a non-zero beta function. Now, in order to compute it, we need to have some sort of an approximation scheme. A useful perspective is to think about that we are working with a metric which is weakly curved. So the first thing we can think about is to look at the space-time, which is almost flat, or at least it's flat on the scale of the string. And has curvature, which is small in units of the string scale. So if you do that, then this beta function would be small, and we can compute it perturbatively in the curvature. If I normalize things like this, in terms of the string tension 1 over alpha prime, then this perturbation theory is essentially going to be a perturbation theory in alpha prime. Now, this is essentially behaving like H bar. So at the leading order, the beta function turns out to be the same, to be proportional at least, to the curvature, the Ricci curvature of spacetime. So this is rather striking. It means that at least at the leading order, a small curvature, a string can propagate in a space-time if and only if the space-time satisfies the Einstein's equations. So now everything is suddenly self-consistent. I have a graviton, and it only propagates in the background of gravity. Now we can be a little bit more precise about that. Suppose that I'm really doing an expansion of g mu nu as eta mu nu plus a small fluctuation. And suppose I'm computing a scattering amplitude. Okay. So I have my path integral over the axis. I have a bunch of vertex operators inserted. And then I have my action. The first term is just the usual action on flat space, and then I'm gonna put alpha prime here. Why not? Now, suppose I expand this in a power series. If you stare at it enough, you can see that, or if you want to expand this in Fourier series too, you can see that this is just the vertex operator for the graviton. So if I expand this in a power series, this looks like a scattering amplitude of this strings in the in a coherent background of gravitons. So somehow the change in the action for the string can be expressed in terms of adding a vertex operator to my action, or adding a coherent background of string modes to my scattering amplitude. So the first term in the expansion would be just propagation in flat space. In the next term, I bring this down. It looks like the original string modes together with one graviton. I mean, I can really write it that is a superposition of gravitons, because it satisfies the linearized Einstein equations, and so on and so forth. So this I did it for the graviton, but it should be clear that this applies in a pretty general way. So if I have a general string mode, and I'm computing some scattering amplitude in which I've inserted a coherent state of them, so something like that. So if I'm studying some scattering amplitude with some strings that are propagating in a coherent background of another string mode, of a specific string mode, I can I can absorb this, resum it, and absorb it into change of the action. Now, if you remember, the vertex the operators that correspond to string modes must have eigenvalue 1 for a 0 and a 0 bar. So they must have scaling dimension 1, which is precisely what you want for this to be scale invariant and well invariant at the leading order. So the string modes are really in one-to-one correspondence with the infinitesimal perturbations of the action for my string. So this is what I was saying at the beginning of this series of lectures. In string theory, every continuous deformation of my theory can be converted into a coherent state of some field in the theory, at least at low energy.
Mm-hmm. When you say deformation of your theory, yes. You mean, and still with like such that the entire theory has the same symmetry?
Well, the string theory can be defined. Okay. Meaning, right, for example, so the Schwarzschild theory, so such that the Schwarzschild theory still has wide invariance and diffeomorphism invariance. Actually, there is, if you look at the deformations of the conformal field theory and the deformations of the string theory, you'll find that the string theory has one more deformation. There's just one vertex operator which looks like it's doing nothing to the conformal field theory, but it just ends up changing a little the coefficient you put in front of the loop amplitudes. And that is the dilaton. But I'll get to it in a moment. So, which one is now? I get to it. But it's not actually working. Pepper is stuck there. Okay. I'm sorry. Yes, I'll do it manually, but if needed. But it just doesn't. So this is supposed to be the front in the middle, according to them. Okay, whatever. So. Let's see what sort of couplings correspond to the other string modes. So the graviton clearly corresponds to changing the metric of the space-time. So if you remember that our massless string modes were things written like a minus one mu a minus one bar nu on a Fock space vacuum, which is dx mu d bar x nu e to the I dx. Okay. So with the graviton, I more or less dealt with the symmetric combination of dx mu and the bar x nu. If you remember, the trace part was supposed to be the dilaton. You might wonder where the dilaton end up in here. I get to that in a moment. For now, I'm just writing the action like this with some symmetric matrix. So the simplest modification I can do is to add an anti-symmetric matrix. Ah, sorry, it was terrible. I was confusing the worksheet and space-time indices. Okay. So this is the coupling of a string to an anti-symmetric tensor, to a true form. Now, what's the physical meaning of this? This is essentially the string version of a coupling to electromagnetism. So if a particle couples naturally to a one form. In electromagnetism, the action of the coupling of a particle to a gauge field is just that you integrate the gauge field along the trajectory of the particle. A string has a two-dimensional trajectory, and so it couples naturally to a true form. So this is a true form under which the string is an electrically charged object, for which the string is an electrically charged object. Now, once you start doing loops, that once you start doing perturbative calculations in this quantum field theory, to try to compute the beta functions and things like that, you'll discover that there is another natural counterterm that one should add to the action, which starts appearing at one loop, which is not really easy to write down in conformal gauge, so let me just put the metric back. Which looks like this. Uh, Well, this is the curvature of the metric on the worksheet. And this is a field in space-time, which we'll call the dilaton. Now, as you can see, if I put a constant mode of this dilaton, this term shifts the action by the total curvature of your Riemann surface, which is something like, it's proportional to one minus the genus. Sorry. So this essentially multiplies your string amplitudes by I hope I have my sign right. I might have gotten the sign wrong. So the effect of changing the constant mode of this dilaton is literally to change the coupling of your string theory. See, genus G is just the number of loops of your string theory worksheet. Okay, so A0 comes out of spheres with punctures, A1 comes out of tubes. A1 comes out of torus with puncture. A2 comes out of a surface with shoe loops, and so on and so forth. Now, of course, you are in bosonic strings, so unfortunately, you know, besides this mass zero, these massless fields in space-time, you also have a tachyon. Which looks like just a potential on your scalar fields. Now, so you can start from this action, perturbation theory in alpha prime, write down the beta functions. So you get some beta function for the metric, for the B field, for the dilaton, also for the tachyon, of course, but I'll just pretend it's not there. And this will look like equations of motion. So roughly, this will be the equation of motion for graviton, the equation of motion for the B field, for the dilaton, for the tachyon. And it turns out that this equation of motion comes from an action, from an effective action in space-time. Which I can write like this. So if you vary this action with respect to the metric, you get a beta function for the metric. If you vary it with respect of B, you get a beta function for B. If you vary it with respect of phi, you get a beta function for phi. So this is at low energy how bosonic string theory looks like if I ignore the tachyon. So it's a pretty reasonable action for the metric, for the B field. And for phi. Do you have any questions?
Mm-hmm. So are those literally beta functions?
Yes.
Why should we expect the vanishing of all the beta functions like fixed point, why should we expect those to be the equations of motion?
So those are equations which must hold for the string to be able, for string theory to exist. Now, of course, you can ask why are these the same as I would find from looking at the scattering amplitudes of string theory and interpreting them in terms of an effective action. So this is a very good question. And let me see if I can answer it properly. So the equation of motions from the point of view of S-metrics essentially answer the following question. If I try to add a coherent state of particles, how do I say this? So when we're studying scattering amplitudes, we saw sort of the conditions which on-shell strings would satisfy, right? These are linearized equations of motion. So how do the full equations of motions appear? Well, this has to do with the anomalies, small problems in the BRST symmetry. So in order for the string theory to be well defined, it must be true that if something is Q exact, the amplitude is zero. And usually we show this by saying, okay, if this is Q exact, I can integrate by parts, move Q somewhere else. And it would kill everything we see. And so everything works. But if you remember, I said, when you have these integrated vertex operators, Q doesn't quite kill them, but makes them into a total derivative. Okay? So now you need to ask, make sure that this total derivative really integrates to zero. Now, the way a total derivative might not integrate to zero is that it might, the integral might have some boundary terms. So if I integrate the derivative of f from a to b, I get f of b minus f of a. So what are these boundaries? These boundaries, well, so say I'm doing a three-level amplitude. I'm integrating my puncture over the plane. And there are places, there are other punctures. So the boundaries of my integral are when the situations where the puncture I'm integrating comes very close to another puncture. Another way to say is that if I really want to do this correlation function in this integral, I might have to introduce a little regularization and integrate everywhere except the neighborhood of the punctures. But then I'm going to get some problem with the BRST decoupling if the contribution from the boundaries does not go to zero. So the contribution from the boundary is closely related to the sort of divergences that you encounter where V collides with other vertex operators or when different Vs collide among themselves. Okay? So this is precisely the source of renormalization group flow in the quantum field theory. You are the form, is the collision of the operator of your interaction of the operators which define your interactions. So these are divergences that come, I think, from large momenta or from short distances. So essentially what I'm saying is that the beta functions that you usually compute in the two-dimensional quantum field theory and express your problems with the regularization of these interactions, also pop out when you try to check if the scattering amplitudes are BRST invariant. And if these problems did not exist, then checking that the theory makes sense would just correspond to checking that V is Q closed, essentially that V is on shell, right? So that V satisfies L0 V equal to V and is killed by the positive viral zero modes. And those are the linearized equations of motion. But now that I'm learning that I'm getting extra terms in that induction of Q from the collision of the Vs, that essentially means that the equations of motion become nonlinear. So when I try to check that Q of something, the couples, I get something which is just Q acting on a V. That's the linearized equation of motion. But then I get something that comes from the collision of two Vs and is quadratic in the polarization, in the strength of this fluctuation. It's quadratic in the field. Or something that comes from three Vs, and so it's cubic, and so on and so forth. So whenever I do the equations of motion for, say, the dilaton or the graviton, right, I will see that instead of having p squared epsilon mu nu of p squared of p equal to zero, I'll have some extra terms that come, something involving epsilon and epsilon, something involving epsilon and epsilon and epsilon, and so on. So this is simultaneously the corrected equation of motion for the string, but also the beta function for the quantum field theory. Because BRST symmetry is very closely tied to the Weyl symmetry. Okay, I understand this is a still pretty hand-waving explanation. It would take a little bit more effort to really go and check in detail that these things are true. Also, checking it can be rather tricky in the sense that, for example, the beta functions beyond the first order, beyond the leading order, have all sorts of ambiguities associated to different choices of regularization of how you regularize your actual path integral and how you're, which regularization scheme are you using. And if you really want to match what you get out of the scattering amplitudes with beta functions, it takes a lot of care. Also, in a sense, the action of the equation of motion, right, the scattering matrix is a very gauge invariant notion. Equations of motions or even action is much less invariant because you can always redefine your fields. This will not change the physical questions of a scattering amplitude. So you're trying to match something that is uniquely defined with something that is defined up to field definitions. So it takes a little bit of work. Okay. Now, this action is still a little bit different from what you would expect to see, because in Einstein, you would expect not to have this e to the 2 phi in front of the Einstein action. Now, this is easily amended by redefining g by some exponential of phi. If you pick the correct alpha, it's very easy to rewrite this action as an integral of square root of determinant or g hat times the Ricci scalar built out of g hat plus dot dot dots. Okay. This also helps you understand where the dilaton had hidden. If you express this is really the metric which corresponds to the gravitons. So this is the thing that really gives you the gravitons when you expand it. And so when you expand in small fluctuations, g hat and phi, here you will both find the gravitons contracted with the x mu, and the dilaton modes contracted with the trace of dx, d bar x. Actually, the vertex operator for the dilaton is, so the usual expression for the naive expression for the vertex operator of the dilaton is not quite correct. If you check if this is a primary, this is killed by L1 and 2 and so on, you find that it needs to be corrected by some tense which involves the ghosts. These terms are not very important. When you insert them in this action, they almost drop out, except for this. So there is something that looks like del bar BC e to the I BX. Del bar BC is the conservation for the Gauss number current. In flat space is zero. But in curved space, it's proportional to the curvature. So that's how this pops out. It's a pretty messy calculation, though you can find it in Polchinski. Okay. So the takeaway lesson from today is that the string theory can be coupled to backgrounds. These backgrounds has to satisfy certain equations of motion. And these backgrounds can also be identified with coherent states of string modes. Now, everything I've done here was at weak curvature. And at weak curvature, so when the curvatures are weak, we found that string theory behaves like a pretty reasonable theory of gravity, coupled to these other massless fields and to the massive string modes. Next week, and perhaps in the next 15 minutes, we'll start seeing what happens if the curvatures over the space-time has structure on scales that are the same order of magnitude as the string scale. So we'll look at examples where string theory does not behave like a naive theory of gravity. So as long as the geometry of space-time is big, has features on large scales, strings move around the geometry in a conventional way. When the features of this geometry start being smaller, strings will start doing funny things. So Any questions before we continue? Okay. So the simplest example of a spacetime with structure is a spacetime where one direction has been made into a circle. So I would like to study a very innocent looking problem, which is the propagation of a string in R 24 times 1 times S1 with some radius. So I'm going to study what happens to a string in a periodic space-time. So this, let's say that this is the direction x25. So, and I just call it y because I don't want to write 25 infinitely many times. So I want to study essentially a free scalar field, y, with periodic boundary conditions, with a periodic identification. Okay. So let's expand it in Fourier modes. Let's work on the cylinder as usual, and expand it in Fourier modes. Now, the main consequence of this constraint, well, this constraint has two consequences. The first is that the zero mode of y lives on a circle, which means that the momentum of y is quantized. Okay, that's pretty standard. The second consequence is that when you go around your cylinder on the worksheet, you might happen to go around the circle several times. So it's possible to consider a string which winds around space-time a certain number of times. So my string modes will have now two discrete quantum numbers, the momentum and the winding. So I can write the expansion for y in this way. So the momentum is discrete, as I said, where R is an integer. And W is the number of times the string winds. See, as sigma goes to sigma plus 2 pi, y goes to y plus 2 pi R W. So it's literally the number of windings. It's useful to define the zero modes again. Now they look like this. So here are ground states, which are labeled by these two integers, M and W. They have conformal dimensions, or L0 eigenvalues, which are p squared over, essentially. So now things look pretty symmetric between M and W. Indeed, I could, I could imagine defining a new operator, conjugate to W, so defining an operator x tilde with the property that e to the I x tilde shifts the amount of winding. Once I define this guy, I can define a whole new field. So I assemble the modes into a new scalar field, which has essentially the same A's and opposite A bars. And this field satisfies the same equation of motions as Y. The main difference is that it has periodicity. Over R. So there is no way to distinguish the theory defined by this field and the theory defined by this field. They give the same Fock space, the same local operators. Well, the latter I'm going to discuss more clearly in a moment, but they definitely the same Fock space. And then by the state operator map, they must have the same operators because they have the same states. So the states are just built out of these ground states using a certain number of A's and A-bars. But that means that the whole string theory cannot distinguish a circle with radius R, a circle with radius 2 over R. Now, here I'm working in units where alpha prime is 1. Okay? So if I put alpha prime back, a circle of that is big with respect to the string scale would be the same as a circle which is very small compared to the string scale. But this also tells you that a circle of radius proportional to the string scale can be inverted to another circle, more or less to the size of the string scale. So what it says is that strings see the geometry in a very bizarre way once the features of the geometry start being the same size as the string scale. So this relation is called t-duality. And this really shows you the difference between a quantum field theory and a string theory. In quantum field theory, what happens if you take your space-time and you compactify one direction and you make the direction very small? Suppose I have quantum electrodynamics in four dimensions. I make one direction very small. What do I get? Any guess? Yes, the momentum modes, Kaluza-Klein modes become very massive. I integrate them away, and I'm left with a three-dimensional QED. This is a very universal property of quantum field theory. It's very intuitive. If I put a quantum field theory in a space-time with a very small circle, at low energy, it's the same as a quantum field theory on a space-time one to a lower dimension. But that's not the case in string theory. String theory wants to live in 26 dimensions. If you try to make one dimension very small to make it disappear, out pops out a dual dimension. So see what else to say today. Right, so this is the first example of duality in string theory. There's a relation with matches to different looking string theories, naively different looking string theories. Bosonic string on a with a circle of radius r, and bosonic string with a circle of radius 2 over r. And this relates a weakly coupled string theory, say, to another weakly coupled string theory. We'll encounter other more interesting dualities, or will not, unfortunately, encounter. But there are other more interesting dualities which relate string theory weak coupling with string theory strong coupling. But this was the first example of duality. And it also shows, right, that the classical intuitions about geometry become inadequate at the string scale. So So one way string theory gets around the difficulties of quantum gravity is by changing the way space-time behaves at small scales. Now, I have a couple of minutes. I would like to discuss a little bit the how operators look like in this theory. There is no way to get this one to move away, right? Okay, this is getting ridiculous. Okay, I guess you're right, the manual works. So, so there must be vertex operators which are dual to these states. He might ask, how do I represent these vertex operators in the quantum field theory of the free scalar? So we said that this corresponds to string states where the field winds a certain number of time around the circle, which means that if I apply the state operator map, I want to describe an operator with a property that the field winds a certain number of time around it. So that y of e to the 2 pi I z equals y of z plus 2 pi w r. So this is a bit of an unusual field, an unusual operator. It's not defined in terms of the field itself. It's defined as a boundary condition for the field. So what this operator, the prescription to do calculations with this operator placed here is that you should take your path integral and integrate over y's, which have this funny periodicity condition around this point. So now in practice, the computing the correlation functions of these operators turn out to be very straightforward, just because morally speaking, if I were to split my y into a holomorphic plus antilomorphic part. If I call it tilde, there's sort of the difference between them. Then this operator can be written as e to the I, well, whatever was up there, m over r minus r w over 2 y left plus I m over r plus r w over 2 y right. So essentially, so let me call this P left and P right. So when you compute correlation functions of all these operators, you end up with expressions which are very similar to the ones we found for the usual vertex operators, just that the holomorphic coordinates have powers to depend on this specific combination of winding and momentum. So you can use these relations to compute scattering amplitudes between momentum or winding modes of the Tachyon, say. And this shows pretty clearly that the answers are going to be essentially independent of this. When you switch M's and W's. As I see, it just corresponds to switching the sign of his of P lefts, of all P lefts. Now, if you look at the spectrum of strings in the presence of this circle, you can find some surprises, especially when the circle, the size of the circle becomes sufficiently small. Essentially, now your momentum, your, how do you call it? Your own shell condition involves right, relations like if P is the momentum in the other direction, like P squared plus P left squared plus the number of oscillators the level on the holomorphic side equal to 1. And square over 2 plus P right square over 2 plus the number of the level of oscillators on the right equal to 1. So depending on the size of the radius, you might actually find so the mass of the mass of the string states will depend on the radius. So you have both the and you might find new massless states that appear when the radius is sufficiently small. When you make the radius of order of the string scale, you can find interesting new degrees of freedom which, or another way to say, is that if you start with big radius and you make it increasingly small, for a while the low degrees of freedoms are the graviton and the B field and the dilaton. But at some point when the circle becomes sufficiently small and then tries to become small enough that you can dualize, the degrees of freedom have to reorganize themselves in an interesting way. So new degrees of freedom will appear, other degrees of freedom will start becoming more massive. Okay, I think this is more or less it.